Crybaby.
His name is Quince Pearson. Quince has black hair, expressive hands, an infomercial smile I will never have. He's the star basketball player, but we share an honors history class because Quince is not afraid to be smart, to crinkle up his forehead and consider the past. My heart burst last week when Quincy did a presentation on Euripides. He unzipped his khaki uniform shorts at the front of the classroom, scissor-kicked them off his ankles till his belt buckle clacked against the wall. We all stared at Quince's Abercrombie boxers, his pale, hairless legs, as he said, "Euripides pants off. That's how you want to remember this dude." I think Quince is the most creative person I've ever met. He is 11 going on 20. Today, my homeroom teacher, Mrs. McBoner, wheels over our classroom television and fumbles to click it on for the morning announcements. Her name is really Mrs. McBride, but we've renamed each of our teachers and given them upgrades. Miss Clit, Mrs. Tear My Condom, Dr. Gooch, Miss Daikuchi. The TV snaps on and off, switches channels, because some kids in class installed computer programming into their wristwatches, and this allows them to control the TV. Sometimes, during a test, one of them will turn the TV on mute, raise the volume to max, then unmute so the speakers blare some kind of Days of Our Lives romance scene. This made Mrs. Tear My Condom cry on behalf of Mr. Tear My Condom being dead and her suspicion that he was reaching out to her in this small, tacky way. I'm in middle school now, and my best friend's name is Clarissa Donato. She's in the seat next to me, taking notes on the morning announcements. We're best friends because Clarissa is also tormented, and together, we torment other losers. She's got a scraped-off dinner plate kind of face, round, blemished, pale, but she's the smartest girl in school with the bubbliest handwriting. Today, a boy named Harry sits behind her, bouncing his sneakers on her metal desk basket until her double chin jiggles. "Fat fuck, fat fuck, fat fuck," he whispers, leaning his lumpy pink face into the back of her hair. But Clarissa is used to this by now, a pro. She never cries. Her eyes don't even leave the TV screen. The high schoolers on television read from a sheet of paper. They make stupid jokes and talk about Dan Marino's legacy and how he will build us a new football field made of state-of-the-art AstroTurf. His son attends our school, but he doesn't even play football. He's into drama. "Surprise, surprise," the high schoolers say on the screen. "A middle school dance this weekend. No uniforms necessary. It's going down in the gym." I reach over to grab Clarissa by the shoulder, but she gives me a look like, "Ugh, stop." Clarissa is my only friend, but she is also trying to move up. Outside school, we sing every word of Rent, tell secrets, and look up pictures of bonsai kittens with the bedroom lights off. Her mom makes us bake ziti and classic Italian desserts. I attend Clarissa's soccer games. But in school, our friendship is cautionary. Clarissa grew up with members of the A crowd, the most popular, and when they start on me, she's allowed to join in on the chanting. "Your underwear is showing, Queera. Get bent." I know where I stand. I wear a soup thermos with a strap around my neck, a back brace. I have an imaginary boyfriend named Brahman. I roll a suitcase filled with books because my equestrian posture is still considered precious and can't handle any excess weight. My nose bleeds onto my desk at least twice a day. I want Clarissa to move up, and I'm no good for that. It's an arrangement I understand. A deal I would, and eventually will, gladly take for myself. It's 1999, and our prep school is one of the first in the country to issue mandatory laptops to every student. They're called Study Pros, and they're wired to a group of men in the library called the Tech Center, who observe and control how we use them. If we get distracted in class, clicking around on Napster, a member of the Tech Center will often move the arrow of our mouse directly to the X, like some phantom conscience. Recently, a member of the Tech Center called my father to tell him I had downloaded porn videos onto my Study Pro after school hours, when I didn't think it counted. My father told him to go fuck right off. We call the Study Pros crap tops. They look like baby tombstones, cold to the touch, a gritty silver with blue rubber bumpers and handles. Because the school says they are indestructible, each class has made it their mission to destroy them. There's nothing more thrilling than watching the A crowd hurl their computers into the school lake and then onto the asphalt of the pickup loop, where high schoolers run them over in BMWs. The only way they stop is if the president's Maybach creeps up. The president of our school, a huge booming man with pants too short, has a chauffeur drive him from building to building in order to keep us in line. He'll be investigated for fraud and money laundering just after we graduate, claims he will deny, but right now, this is still his school, his ways. Clarissa and I are waiting outside the drama building for our moms to pick us up. She's just finished a key club meeting, and I've just exercised one of the school horses, an asshole gelding named Kale, who lives here on campus. "Do you think I can email Quince?" I ask her, about the school dance. I step on top of my crop top in my riding boots and jump a little. This is about as much as I can do without feeling guilty. "You're loco," she says. "We're not even supposed to go to this thing. Dances like this are not for people like us." "Maybe I should just tell him how I feel," I say. "What about Brahmin?" she laughs. "Get out with that. Boys are supposed to ask girls. Don't be desperate." "It could go good with Quince. I can write a good email." "I can't do this right now," says Clarissa. "The girls are coming soon." Clarissa promised her psych homework to the A crowd, tight papers on the groupthink in 12 Angry Men. "My parents say I should always express myself," I say. "Do not touch your crop top," says Clarissa. "That would be so fucking embarrassing." The A girls trickle out of the building across from us. They gather under a palm tree, unbutton their skirts, and let them drop to the grass like dead birds. Beneath their uniform skirts, the girls all wear tight cotton shorts with slits up the sides. The shorts are called Sophie's, and my mother won't buy them for me because everybody else wears them. She says they look cheap, and why would you want to wear the same shorts as these skank-ass white brats? Clarissa swings her pink JanSport backpack over one shoulder. Two shoulders would be social suicide, and waves me off. "Do not," she says, between her teeth, as she smiles and skips toward the girls. Years later, my mother will tell me that she prayed to a higher power every day, that maybe, just once, she might find me standing with the other girls at the school pickup loop, laughing. "Don't be alone," she would repeat in the car. "For once, don't be alone. Let those girls talk to her. Let her act like a skank-ass boca bitch if that's what it takes. Just don't be alone." The next morning, before school, my study pro lights up with an email from Q Pearson88. "Be my date to the dance," it says. "Too shy to ask. Meet you there." "I have a date to the middle school dance," I tell my parents. My father is lying on the living room couch, propped on an elbow. He drops his roll of newspaper on the floor, his sports bet scrawled over it in blue and red smears. He says, "Who? I mean, who's the lucky guy? I mean, I'll chop his balls off." I love when this happens in the movies, on TV, in the books I read. A boy comes for a girl, and then the father suddenly loves the girl more, steps up, becomes protective. No boys or men have ever desired a fatherless girl. I have always wanted this complication. "Don't say that," I laugh, swatting him in the arm. He takes me down to the couch with him in one swift yank. On my father's four TVs, four different announcers give us some stats. Dad says the Raiders will pay my college tuition one day, if we play our cards right. "What's this? What are you saying?" My mother's sitting on the floor in the corner of our living room, next to the television pyramid, organizing stacks of CDs for her new catalog-ordered player. "Mom, you won't believe it." "Believe this," she says. "Watch." She punches in a number, 57, and the player glows blue, spins all the glittering CDs around like a fan. Michael Bolton's voice seeps out of the speakers. "Like magic," she says. "It's like a goddamn computer, this thing." "Enough with the Michael Bolton," screams my father. "And Rich Gannon passes. It's the Raiders," screams the announcer. "I have a date to the middle school dance," screams me. "Wait for another," screams my mother, punching in a new number. Enough with the Wilson Phillips. My mother stands up and grabs hold of my hands. We dance to our song. Someday somebody's gonna make you want to turn around and say goodbye in front of the televisions. Where'd you two even come from? Says my father. He can't help but smile. Not from me. My mother wants to dress me for the middle school dance. She drives me to the Boca Raton Town Center Mall, pulls our car up to the valet. Limited two or Delia's? She asks, giving me a nudge, because these are the stores of my dreams, the stores I haven't been old enough to shop in yet. These stores sell Spice Girl lollipops and the lowest pants and the finest glitters that don't rain off. Inside Limited 2, my mother chooses a baby blue tank top with clouds on it. She holds it up between her fingers, the V-neck cut out, a white sparkling shoelace that ties the V tight. She walks me to a dressing room and hands me a black miniskirt with two baby slits up the sides. It's too tight on me and too short, but my mother says, "Celebrate those legs," as she pulls me out from behind the dressing room curtain. I can barely move my thighs in the skirt, so I shuffle my feet. You don't ride horses for nothing. It's too much, I say. The Backstreet Boys sing through the store speakers, and I feel embarrassed, like a little girl, just listening to the way they want it, while I'm wearing this outfit. My legs are scarred and paled from my half-chaps, from all the stiff boots and pinching stirrup leathers over the years. Even worse, they're hairy, especially my knees. You're just used to that long, fugly uniform, Skort, she says. You look hot like this, trust me. Quince will drop dead. Will you let me nair for this, I ask, please? I'll think about it, she says. It is a special occasion. After the mall, my mother drives us down to Fort Lauderdale to my uncle's shoe warehouse. My other uncle, Uncle Bert, works the forklift inside. The warehouse is a giant, chalky-smelling place with leaning mountains of white shoe boxes. They each have our name, Madden, printed all over them. Some of the shoes are new, but others are damaged discards. Two left feet, a nail in the insole, and sometimes I'm allowed to climb up and pick from these piles. My Uncle Bert hops off his forklift when we pull up to the side entrance of the warehouse. He licks his fingers and smooths down his mustache. He looks like my father if my father were to quit shaving and wear tube socks and take up the Grateful Dead. He's my favorite uncle. Did I hear my favorite girl found a date to the middle school dance? He says. With Quince Pearson, I say. That's not just any date, says my mother. Quince Pearson, I think I've heard of him, says Uncle Bert. He pulls a soft pack of smokes from the front pocket of his plaid shirt. About this tall? Yes. Handsome? Yes. Best taste in girls? Uncle Bert, stop, I laugh. I can't stop laughing. I am 11 years old, and I can finally joke about love. Stand up inside it. Uncle Bert lets me climb the shoe mountains for the rest of the day. Find the perfect dancing shoes, he says. Better be dynamite. I love opening each box under the humming ginger glow. I love the crackle of tissue paper, the smell of suede and glue. I can barely fit into even the smallest of the shoes, but I still know every term, what I like and what I don't like. The choke is all wrong. The toe spring is perfect, because this has become one of the many languages of our family. All the VJs and pop stars on MTV have made my uncle's shoes extra famous, so the A-girls recently asked me for a new white chunky sneaker called the Bobby. If you deliver, Addison Katz said, we'll be your very best friends. I came to the warehouse, and Uncle Bert helped me collect and label the Bobby boxes, each in every size. My mother wrapped them in expensive paper, pressing each crease with a gentleness that wrung some kind of sadness inside me. The next day, when I handed over the gifts next to our school lockers, the girls tore open the boxes, tied up the laces, and left the wrapping paper crunched in the halls. They never spoke to me again, but the shoes are worn in by now. On the floor of her bedroom, my mother does her best to curl my hair with hot rollers. My hair is too short for this, an ear-length bowl, so we decide to move on. She surprises me with a box of tiny plastic rhinestone flowers that open like clams and snap onto strands of hair, and she clips them all over until my head looks like a cluster of stars. Tonight, she lets me remove all the orthodontic bands from my mouth. I spit my plastic lip bumper into its case, slide my headgear out of its molar hooks, and now my mouth is only partially metal. My two lips meet for the first time in a year. My mother swipes a berry-colored powder across my cheeks and some sky blue eyeshadow to match my shirt. I walk down the hallway toward my father on the couch. He stands up, something he seldom does. "You look beautiful," he says, without sarcasm. "I'll be damned." My parents drive me the 5 minutes to school. I've never seen it at night before, and suddenly it feels bigger, more dangerous, like what I imagine a college might look like. "Go find your man," screams my mother, as I shut the car door. I wave them goodbye, walking backward, until the taillights on their new Mercedes shrink and die out. I like the hallways when they're like this, dark and gaping. Usually, I have to be careful of somebody coming up behind me to unzip my suitcase or smack a sign on my back. But right now, in this moment, I'm the most beautiful girl in the hallway. I am night blooming in my cloud shirt and black leather platforms with my very own name inside. I am a girl with a date attending my very first dance. "Quira," says Clarissa. She arrived with the A-girls but promised to sneak back out of the gym and find me in the halls. She looks nice, wearing a slinky rhinestone dress and crown of butterfly clips. Her black curls are gelled into a bun, and she looks skinnier tonight. I wonder if she's been eating. Weeks ago, when she bent over to use her locker, a boy named Ian screamed, "Slim fast!" and the whole hallway roared. Since then, I've only seen her suck down plastic tubes of fat-free yogurt in the cafeteria. Sometimes, she and the other girls chew on granola bars and spit the brown pulp back into plastic cups. All the taste, no calories. "How do I look?" I ask, taking a deep breath. "Your skirt is totally slit up the side, you know that, right? How very contrampo casual of you." I look down and Clarissa is right. My skirt must have ripped when I was climbing out of the back seat. The front and back are connected by only a few thick threads. My whole thigh is showing, along with my tie-dye limited to underwear. "Well, now the fuck what?" I say. "My parents aren't coming back for hours." "You're such a boner killer, you know that?" she says. "Come on." Clarissa leads me to a classroom, Mrs. Badge's. The lights are still on. Student government runs late here, and Clarissa is in charge of the key. I've run for student government twice. Don't be saddened, vote for Madden, but never made the cut. Both times, my mother baked campaign cookies for the entire middle school that everyone devoured, mumbling, "Who knew she could make cookies without fortunes inside?" Inside Mrs. Vadge's room, in this kind of light, Clarissa's glitter and charcoal makeup looks exaggerated and clownish. I wonder if I look the same. She walks over to Vadge's desk and picks up a stapler. "Come here," she says, getting on her knees. I walk over to her. "Take the shoes off," she says. "I can't even reach your ankle." Shoes are the one thing I have on girls my age. Most girls in middle are allowed one pair of starter heels for dressy occasions, strappy kitten things only a half inch off the ground, the kind of shoes my veiny calf grandma might wear. I've been wearing platforms and clogs most of my life, sample style stuffed with padding, with cheetah patterns, leather tassels, sawtooth soles. They don't match our uniforms, but they're not banned from school yet. Clarissa works from the top and works her way down and around, snapping the jaws of the stapler quickly, efficiently, like she's done this before. She pop, pop, pops the metal teeth like bullets. She pulls the fabric together and squeezes. She reloads the stapler and works until my whole side looks silver. "An improvement," she says. Clarissa can be cruel, a real bitch. She lies and taunts and she can't be trusted, not yet. But here's the thing. She loves me more than any other friend I've ever known. There is a tenderness between two people who desire so much more than what they can have. who reach for the cards they have not been dealt. Two girls who will soon be ridiculed for exposing their hairy backs at a bar mitzvah service. Did you goats escape from the petting zoo? Who will spend the next few years quietly shaving each other down the spine in an empty bathtub, bleaching each other's mustaches, helping each other vomit up cheese fries and pastries. These little tasks that seem to us, to so many young girls, like the very membrane between a life of being seen and no life at all. My love for Clarissa is so strong it changes the temperature of the air around us. That's how it feels. Which is precisely the thing about losers. The thing that binds us here on Mrs. Vag's floor, and the thing that will bind us even after we change, grow up, become new people, meet other former and current losers. Losers stick together. We recognize one another. 18 years from this moment, when I watch Clarissa walk down the aisle on her wedding day, her skin is flawless as skim milk in a white, backless dress. There are laser lights, black lights, and strobe lights. The gym is foggy and loud. The DJ blasts everyone's new favorite song, No Scrubs, and the crowd sings along with their hands cupped around their mouths. Want to get with me with no money? Oh no. I recognize only some of the kids on the dance floor. The kids from my classes, the honors kids, sit on the bleachers chewing at hangnails. Clarissa and I scan this group, looking for Derek Jacobs. Do you think he kept his highlights in? She asks, and we grab each other by the elbows, snort laughing. Derek sits in front of us in German class, and lately Clarissa and I have been untwisting our milky pens, running the pastel-colored ink through his black curly mullet. Derek is a genius, and he doesn't care what anyone thinks of him, and so we hate him. At 12 years old, he will be the youngest certified engineer employed by Microsoft. At 14, he will be the first person implanted with a microchip on national television. He'll be honored by Oprah and Bill Gates. At 18, he'll die in a motorcycle accident. Are you ready for a new hit? The DJ asks. He instructs us to make a circle in the center of the room. He wants to see us move it, move it. He plays Juvenile's Back That Ass Up, a song Clarissa recently downloaded and played for me. Do you see Quince? Not yet, says Clarissa. I'm sure he'll find you. The A-girls form a circle. It's more shocking than I'd imagined, seeing everyone in their weekend clothes, no button-ups or sweater vests or pleats. The bass thumps wild, and Clarissa and I watch the girls take turns crawling on the floor, then moving flat on their stomachs. They slam their fists on the glossy gym wood as they hump up and down with their groins. They make faces like they're in pain, or maybe it's just that they're feeling really good. I squeeze my thighs together. That's called the crybaby, says Clarissa. My sister told me about that move. The boys take turns approaching the designated crybaby from behind. They move on top of the girls in a push-up position. They roll their bodies and hump the girls, and the girls keep banging the floor with their fists, kicking their legs like they're about to start swimming. Everybody is fake crying, fake rubbing their eyes in exaggerated twists. Quince Pearson is one of these boys. I watch him hump the crying Skylar Fingerhut, the crying Claudia Greenberg, the crying Beth Diaz, the crying Harley Pelletier. After some time, one of the adult chaperones pulls Quince off Addison Katz, shakes her finger. No, 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 that's enough. Do you think he's as nervous to see me as I am to see him? I ask Clarissa. Of course, she says, and wait till he sees your outfit. I've never danced before, I say. Nothing like that. We'll practice, she says. Don't worry. Now that the crying is over, a new circle has formed. One boy has taken off his tie, and he wraps it around another girl's neck. When he does this, the two of them sway into the center of the circle. The girl bends over, plants her hands on her knees. She gyrates her butt up and down as quickly as possible, flinging her crimped hair around in a circle. It's almost like the hula, I think. If hula were to be danced while bent over to angry music in English by horny white people. The girl snakes her tongue out of her mouth and taps the front of her braces with it. She flicks it in and out while she grinds. The boy holds onto her hips and pulls her butt into his body. At one point, he lifts his hand above her bent-over back. He moves his hand up and down, like he's petting a dog or flattening dough. When everyone has applauded and screamed, "Nasty, hot, get it, Danny," it's the girl's turn to take the tie and choose the next boy. She wraps it around Quince Pearson's neck. I watch them dance like that. The pizza dough move, the ass bouncing, her left leg hooked around his back when they face each other, still humping. Clarissa pulls me into the gym locker room. It's so bright in here after the black lights that I have to blink it off in the mirror. My blue mascara and blue eyeshadow are gooping, stinging. "Open your eyes, chink," says one of the girls coming out of a stall. "Oh, that's right, you can't." I am used to these comments. I don't even remember when I began hearing them. But I have a white father and an uncle who makes shoes for white, beautiful celebrities, and I've known my Hanukkah prayer since I was a baby, and mostly I don't understand why other people can see something I can't. This difference about me. All hail power to the earth, power to the water, goddess of the stars and the flames, ni hao, brouhaha, alakazam, o kamikaze. "Jesus Christ with the Wicca," says Clarissa. "You are so embarrassing." Clarissa knows the drill. I wear a pentacle necklace and makeup spells when people give me the most shit. The sterling pentacle screws onto a small cobalt bottle. I tell people the bottle is full of blood, but it's usually cranberry juice or some kind of essential oil my mom gives me for my nosebleeds. Once, I cast a spell on Miss Dickhead, and she fell down a flight of stairs the very next day. I felt bad about that, cut off a lock of my hair, and buried it as some sort of penance, but ever since this incident, people tend to walk away when I start the chanting. "Seriously," says Clarissa, "you need to practice before you go back out there. Show me what you got. You watch them, right? Show me." Clarissa instructs me to bend my knees as much as I can. She uses her hands to help arch my back. She positions my legs so they're farther and farther apart. I try my best to do what I saw. I place one palm on each knee. I bounce up and down. I rock my head back and forth until my hair with its rhinestone clips goes flying. I find what feels like a steady humping motion. "You look like you're having a total fucking seizure," says Clarissa. "But I guess it's not that bad." I keep going. I rock my body back and forth. "Like this?" "Oh my fucking God." A voice. It's Addison Katz. A few of the girls follow her inside the locker room. "What the freak are you doing?" I stand up. "Dancing," I say, "like you." "I'm here with Quince Pearson. We're dates." "Oh, really?" says Addison. Her blonde hair is pinned into a knot in the back of her head. Spikes of it stick out so that it looks like a child's drawing of a sun. Two thin golden strands hang gelled beside her cheeks, and it's all unmoving, bound by glitter hairspray. She's wearing a bandana as a shirt. "Well, in that case," she says, "you need to sex it up a little." Addison and the girls tell me to try the praying crybaby. They tell me this is done in a kneeling position, fists pumping in a tantrum. They tell me to rub my eyes with hard wrist twists, toss my hair even harder. They tell me to cry like the hottest baby that ever cried. "Quince will bust his zipper," Addison says. All the girls nod. Clarissa looks at them, nods too. We leave the bathroom in one big group, ready. Back in the gym, the glow sticks have come out. Everyone is sucking on them, and their teeth glow dirty blues, pinks, and yellows behind their braces. All of us girls walk through the crowd holding hands until we make it back to the center circle. Some of the boys have laced larger glow sticks between their fingers. They move their hands around their bodies and above their heads so that the glow sticks leave figure-eight-shaped trails. "Club Boca up and her," the DJ spits into the mic. "You ready to shake it?" He begins playing another song I've heard before. It's called The Thong Song. Quince Pearson jumps into the center of the circle, raving, his face glowing lime green inside the hoops of light. "Show Quince what you've got," says one of the girls. "Now's your chance," and I feel a push. I move into the center of the circle. Quince looks at me, but instead of grabbing my hand, or taking me in for a hug, or giving me one of his glow sticks, or spinning me around to hump me from behind, or patting my dough, or wrapping his tie around my neck, his eyes bulge and rim white. He backs up out of the circle and into the crowd. Cisco sings about dumps like a truck and thighs like what. I know this is my chance. I know that to back away, to press myself into Clarissa's arms, would mean even more ridicule, being called a fucking wimp. I am a fucking wimp, but this could change all that. I know this could be the last time I am ever asked to a dance. The moves feel more natural with a bass throbbing under my feet, with Cisco's words of encouragement. I dip my butt as low as I can go, pretend to wax the gym floor with it. I push my palms into my knees like I was told, balance my weight, vibrate every muscle as hard as I can manage. The staples in my skirt ping off onto the floor. They scratch at my thighs, open the torn slit, but I don't care. I want to get down. I want to get my freak on. The crowd screams, hollers. I drop on my knees and pump the damp air, thrusting my hips back and forth. I cry, baby, cry. I feel sexy. I feel seen. For the first time, I feel seen as someone sexy. I lean my body forward and flat onto the floor. I give the crowd what they want. I pound the ground with my fists, kick the rubber toes of my platforms. I hump the floor like a dog humps a stuffed lion, deliberate, fast. The song fades out. Something slow leaks in, Casey and JoJo and a few piano keys. Even though I'm dizzy, I pick myself up to stand. Everybody has wet, glowing faces and tears in their eyes. They point at me, bending over, waving away their laughs until they say, it hurts, oh my God, I can't. Quince Pearson has his face buried in a seventh grade girl's shoulder, and I can't tell if he's laughing or crying or both. Clarissa bursts through the circle, takes my hand. Bleachers, she says. We thump up the steps to join the other honors kids. I thought it was good, I say. I felt it. Let's forget that ever happened, she says. Let's not even talk about that ever happening. We watch the girls weave their fingers around the boys' necks for the slow dance. The boys rest their hands on the girls' butts or just above them. They all stand in place. They don't even move a single step. They simply shift their weight from left leg to right leg, swaying a little. It's unimpressive, I think. It's not dancing at all. Did I blow it with Quince? I ask. No, she says. She's quiet for a pause after that. He told me he feels too shy or something. He said something to one of the girls, like he'll ask you to dance when he's got more courage, when the time's right. Clarissa won't look at me as she says this. Maybe he can't even handle me, I say. I think that's it, she says. I think that's it. My father picks me up at 10 o'clock. He's trying to be sober this week, so he's staying close to home, smoking more, yelling less. He lights the end of a new cigarette from the butt already in his mouth, flicks that filter on the school lawn in a scabbed trail of light. How'd it go with Prince Charming? He asks. I love it when my father asks me questions. These moments come in slivers. They're bright and fleeting, and when I catch the insides of them, I feel like the most important man in the world is really listening to me, and with the power of one of his nods, or uh-huhs, or sures, or laughs, I too am important. My father will always have that way about him. But tonight, my throat feels so lumpy and hard, I don't want to talk much. He got too shy, is what I say. My father turns up the radio. It's a Jim Croce song, his favorite. You ever listen to the words here, son? He asks. Operator, oh, could you help me place this call? Sings Jim. No, I say. You should, he says. It's a sad, sad story. The truth is, I waited and waited for Quince Pearson to ask me to dance. I waited on the bleachers long after Clarissa was picked up, until there were only a few people left on the dance floor, until it was only Quince and Candy Schwartz, their arms wrapped tightly around each other, her thumbs hooked on the back belt loops of his cargo pants. I waited until I saw them kiss on the lips, until I stomped down the steps in my platform shoes and tapped him on the shoulder. "Hi, Quince, hi." Until he looked at me in a sad way still lined with kindness, cocked his head, and said, "Hey there, what's up?" I waited. I open the window of the car, stick my hand out into the hot wind. I like the resistance of it. We're miles from the ocean, but I swear I can hear the crash of all those littered waves. "You can keep the dime," sings Jim. "That's the most important lyric," my father says. "Remember that part," he says. After all the calling and calling for his sweetheart, he doesn't even want to get through in the end. Love's barely ever worth it. At home, my mother sits on the living room floor with a joint in her mouth and the red velvet chocolate box where she keeps her stuff. She punches numbers into the CD player, jumps up when I walk through the door. "Hi, baby," she says. "How was it? How was Quince? What happened to your skirt?" "Ripped," I say. My mother knows me best. She knows everything by just looking at me, even when I don't want her to, even when I steady my eyes and fake it. "Take those shoes off," she says. "To hell with middle school dances. We'll have our own dance. We've got the CD player." I kick my feet until my shoes thud against the wall and then the floor. My father picks up one of the 8 remote controls from the coffee table and sits down on the couch. I watch my mother give him that "don't even think about it" look, and he understands, stands back up. My mother punches in a new number, takes a hit. The robot player spins and spins. The speakers thump something disco, chords hot and elastic. The 3 of us dance in a circle, facing one another on the gum-balled carpet, snapping our fingers, throwing the dice. My father lets me stand on his feet as he shuffles and grooves. He holds me tight. He dips my body backward till the room tips over. He says, "One day, you won't even remember this night ever was."